Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Dr. Frank Arco, a vascular surgeon with the Sanger Heart and Vascular Institute and the Carolinas Medical Center in Charlotte, North Carolina. Dr. Arco, who attended medical school at Texas A&M, is an expert on aortic aneurysmal disease, arterial disease, deep vein thrombosis, and several other areas. Dr. Frank Arco, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Okay, so what is the aorta? And why is it important?
Well, the aorta is the main blood vessel that comes off the heart, travels off the heart, through the chest, down through the diaphragm into the abdomen, and carries all the blood flow to all the major organs in the body.
And how does it get corrupted?
Well, there's many ways. The most common way is with advancing age and atherosclerotic disease, hardening of the arteries. And two things can really happen with it. It can narrow and occlude or become stenotic, and the areas of body that it goes to then can become ischemic. And then the other major thing that can happen with it can become weak and aneurysmal, which means basically becomes weak with a risk of rupturing.
Now, every once in a while, you read in a paper that something has happened and there's sort of instant death that comes because of this corruption. What are some of the things that can happen, like an aneurysm? Is there any way that we, the public, can prevent it?
Well, there are certainly risk factors that you can get with regards to aneurysmal disease. Certainly, smoking is a major risk factor, as well as hypertension and obesity. So if you can manage those risk factors, you can hopefully decrease the risk of having aneurysms with advancing age. There are other catastrophic events that can also occur with the aorta, and those would include a type A or a type B dissection, which can also result in sudden death.
Now, what are those?
That's actually a tear in the aorta. A type A dissection is one that actually occurs right near the aortic valve. That's a life-threatening emergency and requires rapid intervention. Usually it's almost always surgery. And then you can also have a type B dissection, which is again a tear, but further along the aorta, usually distal to the artery that goes to the left arm.
Distal meaning?
Away from the vessel that goes to the arm, so further away from the heart.
And how do these tears actually tear?
Oftentimes it can be related to a congenital disease, and some people can just have risk factors for having weakening of those arteries, and they can tear, usually associated with hypertension, and then it can also occur with advancing age as well.
So I take it within your answer comes one thing that everybody ought to be paying careful attention to, which is blood pressure.
That would be correct.
How would you do that? I'll tell you how I do it. I keep a blood pressure monitor, at home, and I see how I'm doing. Should everybody be doing that?
Well, I think, as you get older, you should be doing it. I'm not sure that, young kids should have to be measuring their blood pressure. But certainly, as we get older, we should be seeing our primary care physicians, modifying our risk factors, exercising, watching what we eat, managing our weight, following up with our primary care physicians, and making sure that our blood pressure is controlled, either with those, issues that we can control ourselves, and then finally then with medications.
So how important, you just mentioned it, but how important is weight control?
I think weight control is very important.
Why?
For just your overall health.
Why is that? I mean, I see a lot of healthy looking, big people. Why is it that they put themselves at risk by being fat?
I'm not exactly sure why they do that. I think it's
I don't mean why they do it, but I mean what is it, doctor? But what is it in being overweight that threatens your heart health?
Well, it goes with basically a lack of exercise and then eating the wrong kinds of foods that put the weight on. So you're basically putting in too many calories and not burning enough calories. And with that, you become overweight. That gives you a risk of increasing risk of type 2 diabetes mellitus if you're eating the wrong types of foods. That usually means fried foods, the sedentary lifestyle. That puts you at a higher risk of getting atherosclerotic disease. And with that atherosclerotic disease gives you a higher risk of then aortic aneurysmal disease and aortic atherosclerotic disease, or narrowing of the arteries.
Does fat accumulate around the heart?
Well, the fat can accumulate anywhere in the body, but typically you can get some, you know, fatty appendages around the heart, but you're not going to have just big, giant, you know, globs of fat around the heart.
But if we lose weight, we're always told that weight around the middle is the big tip-off. And then we hear about weight around our organs, fat around our organs, internal. What is so dangerous about that internal fat?
Well, it goes to your overall metabolism. If you're having to store that much fat, that means you usually have increasing levels of cholesterol. And with those increasing level of cholesterol, those usually will be deposited within the arteries. And when they're deposited within the arteries, then those arteries can become narrowed or weakened. And again, when you have that sedentary lifestyle and overweight, that usually goes along with a lot of other things like the wrong sorts of diets, heavy use of or using nicotine products, which basically then puts you at a high risk of atherosclerotic disease. So but you don't have to be overweight to have atherosclerotic disease. You can eat the wrong things without being overweight, sure. Just smoking, those sorts of things. So there are many, many risk factors for this, including genetics.
So let's proceed on genetics for a moment. We now know there are genes that are discoverable in terms of breast cancer. Some people even decide that they're going to prophylactically remove their breasts because of their genes. Is there anything like that with AAA, or as you're an expert in abdominal aortic aneurysms?
Yeah, there are certain genes that you can't have. They've actually discovered that the gene and where it lies for Marfan's disease, and what that allows you to do. And with aortic aneurysmal disease, just a standard, there's around a 20 to 25% risk of passing this along. So there hasn't been a particular gene identified for aortic aneurysms, but certainly you'll see it kind of run in the families. For instance, my grandfather died of a ruptured thoracic aneurysm. I had an uncle die of a ruptured cerebral aneurysm in his head. My father, who's 79 or so, has an aneurysm. It's not that large. It doesn't need to be intervened upon. But I myself probably at some risk of having an aneurysm as I get older. I'm 43 right now. But so I would certainly get checked when I'm about 65 or so.
When you say get checked, what's the check?
The check is actually, fortunately, very easy, simple, non-invasive, and cheap, just like any good screening test should be. And that's an abdominal aortic ultrasound.
Okay, how does that work?
So ultrasound is just sound waves, very similar to how you would, follow a mother and a child as she's pregnant. You'd follow that baby along and you can determine the sex. So it's just sound waves that bounce off and you can determine the size of certain internal structures. So if you go in to get checked with an ultrasound, you'll basically lay flat. They'll put some warm gel on you that will actually transduce the sound waves through your own tissues, and those will reflect back, and you get an image, and you can very quickly and easily and without any pain be evaluated for an aneurysm. And if you have one, depending on its size, you can then be seen by a specialist. And if you don't, then usually you'll probably be okay, long term if you're 65. And what's nice is that as patients go into Medicare and they reach the age of 65, recently in the last several years, the government has passed the SAVE Act. It's S-A-A-A-V-E Act. And so when you get introduced to Medicare, in that, as part of that physical examination, you get a ultrasound. With that ultrasound, you can be diagnosed for an aneurysm. It typically is a disease that occurs in the elderly.
So, the one thing we haven't talked about, Dr. Arco, is exactly what an aneurysm is. It is like a balloon, right, in your aortic mechanism?
That is correct. So an aneurysm really can occur in any blood vessel in the body. The one that we're speaking about for the most part today would be abdominal aortic aneurysms, which would be in the abdomen. So below your diaphragm and above really the kind of the pelvis region or the hip bone. And the most common area is just right below the renal arteries or the arteries that go to the kidneys. And for most people, that would be right around the belly button region or just above that. And what some people will feel, if they're thin enough, is they feel like they can feel their heartbeat in their stomach.
Interesting. So sometimes you have these sense of you can feel your heart pumping in different parts of your body. Is that what you're talking about? You know, in other words, well, if you have your hand, if you see a pulsating or something like that.
Yes, if they're thin enough and they're lying flat, sometimes they'll look down, they can see a little bit of bulge in their abdomen, they can see this kind of what looks almost like a heart beating in their around their belly button region. Some people, when they're sitting and they cross their hands over their stomach region, they can feel their hands being pushed out. In people who are overweight or obese, the physical examination or diagnosing of an aneurysm then becomes a little bit more difficult because it's just harder to feel that way.
Now, these aneurysms for most people are sort of silent killers, aren't they?
That is correct. They usually are asymptomatic. They're usually found incidentally when they're being worked up for something else. So we will usually get referrals from urologists when they're working up elderly men for kidney stones or bladder cancer. They will sometimes find those when they get a CT scan or an ultrasound. People who are older and being worked up for lower back pain when they get an X-ray and the blood vessel is very heavily calcified. They can be seen on that. And then anyone else who's getting a CT scan or an ultrasound for whatever reason may have these diagnosed.
So are you suggesting that sometimes when we catch these, we catch them by accident?
That is correct.
Wow. Is it therefore a disease that is more common among those undetected who have less in the way of resources? In other words, those of us who go to doctors more often than those of us who do not, those accidents of discovery are more likely to happen than if somebody never sees a doctor.
Certainly. You know, if you're not being followed by, you know, your physician or a primary care physician, then the chances of those being found are absolutely probably zero unless the patient diagnoses them themselves by feeling this, you know, heartbeat in their stomach. But if they don't really know what's going on with that and they don't seek medical attention, then they very well could die of that.
So are these aneurysms possible? I know that this is your specialty, the aortic, but are they possible in other parts of your body?
Yes, certainly aneurysms can occur in any part of the body. You can have cerebral aneurysms, which would be up in the brain. Then the next most common, you can have aneurysms on the blood vessel that comes up right off the heart. You can have them in the chest region. You can also have them behind the knee as well.
So just to go over it again, the most likely tip-off that you're at risk is genetics. Is that right?
Well, if I was to give you the most common risk factors or those who are at risk, it would be patients over the age of 65. Any history of smoking, so not a current smoker, just any history of smoking. Hypertension, a family history of aneurysms, and then obesity.
So how fast do you have to get to a doctor when you suspect you've got one of these things?
Well, the risk of rupture really depends typically on the size of the aneurysm. So we really recommend that they be repaired when they get to somewhere between 5 and 5.5.
5.5 and what? So, centimeters?
Five and a half centimeters.
Okay.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. So if it's larger than that, then certainly they need to be seen relatively quickly by a specialist. If it's under 5 centimeters, the risk of rupture really is relatively low. The risk would be a little bit higher in women rupturing at a little bit smaller size. But aneurysms typically are a little bit more common in men than women. It tends to be predominate men about 4 to 1, but certainly women can get aneurysms. I fix many women with aneurysms, so I don't want them to think just because it's much more common in men that they can't have one as well.
I'm always fascinated by why doctors choose certain specialties. And you've already announced or told us that your family has a history of aneurysm. Is that why you chose your specialty?
Actually, it's not. My father is a surgeon, and so it probably got me wanting to go into medicine. I actually, when I went into medicine, wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon. However, when I was in medical school, I worked on an NIH grant and worked on the microcirculation in the coronary system, and I became very interested then in vascular surgery, actually cardiac surgery. But during my training, I worked with one of my mentors, Dr. Clifford Buckley, who's still currently practicing, and he really got me interested in vascular surgery. And then I did my training at Stanford University, and I worked with two more mentors, Christopher Zarens and Tom Fogarty, and they really got me more interested in specializing in aortic work.
We're talking to Dr. Frank Arco, a vascular surgeon with the Sanger Heart and Vascular Institute. Dr. Arco, how do you describe whether a GP can help us discover this thing as well as going to a specialist? In other words, you know, you say you've got to go to your family practitioner, but are they really equipped to be able to say, uh-oh, I don't like what I'm seeing here?
I think they actually are. So not only the general practitioner, but the internal medicine physician and the internist. When you know patients get older and the patients reach the age of 65 and they're being introduced to Medicare, that's certainly one way. Everyone can get that screening at the age of 65, and you get the ultrasound and you get evaluated. We get many patients referred to us from the internal medicine physician and the general practitioner when they do a physical examination on the patient, and they oftentimes can feel this this aneurysm. Oftentimes, they will then get the ultrasound, and if it's a relatively small aneurysm, they're actually pretty well equipped of then just following those aneurysms until they get to the size that needs treatment. So oftentimes, they will diagnose them. They will then follow them, and when there's any increasing in size of the aneurysm or they get to the size of 5, then they will usually refer them to us. So really, anyone can diagnose an aneurysm, and there are many physicians who order, you know, cross-sectional imaging such as CT scans or MR scans or ultrasounds. And then when the patients are found to have an aneurysm, then they will, if they're not comfortable with managing those patients, they will then refer them to us to follow.
Now, Dr. Arco, you've just mentioned a whole bunch of the stuff that fascinates me. One distinction that I really wasn't, and just proves how inadequate I am, but being a family physician as opposed to an internist, what's the difference?
Well, the difference for a family practice physician and a internist, well, I'm not an expert on it, but I did go to medical school, is there's a different residency for those two physicians. Typically, the family practice physician takes care of a wide range of patients, including children, often very old, men and women, with a large variety of diagnoses that they have to manage. But the internist typically tends to focus in a little bit more on the adult age population and probably doesn't do as much with regards to children. That's about probably what I would say on it.
You just said CT scan before, you know, and other kinds of scans. Can you just distinguish between those for us so we know what looks at hard tissue, soft tissue? It would be fascinating to sort of understand our scans.
Sure. So the most simple and the easiest one for patients to undergo would be a duplex ultrasound. which is basically just the sound waves. So they put a transducer on the abdomen, and they can look at a variety of different structures within the abdomen or on the extremities if they're looking at blood vessels and things like that. So that's really non-invasive. There's no risk of radiation with that. There's really no contrast. Oftentimes, it's utilized more as a screening tool, but can give you a lot of very, very good information. The next scan that you would really look at for looking at things inside the body from a vascular standpoint would be the CT scan. And there are a variety of different CT scans that you can get. So you can get a CT scan where you drink contrast. And then there's another, and that's really looking at things like your intestine and your stomach. And then there's another CT scan.
Now, let me interrupt you for a second and ask you about the contrast itself. Is there any danger from that?
With drinking it, it's not that bad. But if you get it through the IV, then that contrast can be nephrotoxic. So it can give issues to some people with their kidneys. Mm-hmm. And then it's an iodine-based dye. So if you have an allergy to iodine, you can have an allergic reaction, which can range anywhere from just simple hives to anaphylaxis. So there are some people that with chronic kidney disease or a little bit elevated creatinine, which is a way to measure that you have to do certain things to either hydrate them before their CT scan or basically just not give them contrast. The other scan that you get, and the other thing with CT scans, there's a significant amount of radiation with that scan. So patients need to understand that and realize that.
If I ask you to compare a chest x-ray with a CT scan, which gives you a greater risk?
Oh, a CT scan gives you a lot more radiation than a standard chest x-ray.
Okay.
The last scan that you can get is MR. This is the one that a lot of patients have a fair amount of trepidation with, mainly due to the fact that you're usually in an enclosed space. So if you have a lot of claustrophobia, that can be an issue. Some of them need some sedation. But there's really no radiation involved with that scan at all, and it's really just based on magnets.
So what do you get from the CT versus the MR? What information is different?
The information from a patient standpoint is really about the same. You get cross-sectional imaging. You can take a look and see really what's going on the inside of the body. With the MR, you can get a lot of dynamic information and kind of see how things are moving, whereas CT is a little bit more of a static image.
But somebody once said to me, I don't remember who, there's a difference in terms of soft tissue versus, harder stuff. Is that right?
Yeah, that's probably true. So you'll see that people who are looking more at soft tissue stuff, so in the joints, really kind of outside my specialty. But if they're looking at the joints and ligaments, you're probably going to get a lot more information with MR over CT.
Are we over-specialized? I ask you that because, as you get older, you go to a lot of different doctors and you've got to sort of manage your own case too often. So I often wonder, whatever happened to the day when you went to one guy and he told you, okay, this is what's up, as opposed to, going to a nephrologist or this or that?
As a specialist, I'd like to say no, we're not too over-specialized. But, with increasing technology and increasing knowledge of all the different disease processes and being able to manage all those things, it is important certainly to have the internist, the family practice doctor. But when it gets to very specific disease processes, I think it is important to have specialists who can manage it. I think that there are certainly many internists and family practice doctors who are very bright, but they become so busy that it's very difficult to keep up with everything that is coming out that's new. And so a lot of times they can diagnose it very well, but to be managed, appropriately with the latest up-to-date tools, probably then at that time it's important to go back to a specialist.
We are talking with Dr. Frank Arco, vascular surgeon at the Sanger Heart and Vascular Institute and the Carolinas Medical Center in Charlotte, North Carolina. Dr. Arco, I guess we should get now to what exactly you do when you repair somebody.
Sure. So with an aneurysm, when we're talking about that, and if we focus in mainly on the infrarenal abdominal aorta, there's really two ways to fix that. In the past, probably around, let's say, just pre-2000, the most common way to fix that aneurysm would be with standard open surgery. That would be going in there, opening up the abdomen, finding the artery, clamping it where it's normal, both proximally and distally, then opening up that aneurysm, removing any thrombus or anything. It's kind of like a toothpaste-type material.
Could you define
thrombus?
Yeah.
Well, it's just kind of old blood in the aneurysm sac. It adds no protection. It only gives you potential risk of it embolizing or moving in the blood system and shutting something off. The aneurysm is actually in your stomach, so it's actually already past your brain. So it would actually, in that instance, just usually move to your feet. But we resect that aneurysm, and then we would replace it with a Dacron-type material or a fabric.
Have we had any trouble with those materials?
Long-term, really not too many problems. There are some issues that can occur long-term that can get infected. It can create a connection between that artery, which we fixed, and part of the intestine, in which you get a fistula, which is called an aortoenteric fistula, which can be an extremely bad problem.
And what's a fistula again?
It's a connection between two different structures. So the artery being connected to your intestine, which means you got a lot of blood going into your basically duodenum, which is right after your stomach. So it results in a very large gastrointestinal bleed.
Okay, so one way to do it is with the fabric. I think you were going to say something else too, right?
Yeah, so that was probably pre-2000. Since 2000, actually, the original clinical trials were in 96, but around 2000, 2001, there was approval for what's now referred to as endovascular stent graft repair. And what we do with that is it basically avoids the open surgical part of the procedure, and through two very small incisions in the groin, a stent graft, or basically the same type of material but with stents on it, can be inserted inside the blood vessels and used to exclude the aneurysm. So the aneurysm actually stays, and then we exclude it.
This gets a little complicated. The stent goes inside the aneurysm, basically, right?
That is correct.
Okay. And then we don't worry about the ballooning because the blood is going through the stent.
That is correct. It's not it's a stent graft, so it's important. So a stent is just a metal scaffold,
right.
And a stent graft has a metal scaffold with the material on the inside.
I'm sorry, you're going to have to go a little bit softer with me on that. So you get you get the metal stent, and inside it you got something. What's the something?
That would be like a graft material. So it could either be a fabric or like a PTFE material.
PTFE is a
It's you might know another name for it is like Gore-Tex. So the same stuff that if you're wearing a jacket made out of Gore-Tex, it's the same thing, PTFE.
So in some cases, they take grafts from dead bodies and things like that for your teeth and other things. Do you ever do that?
Well, you can use a cadaveric graft for replacement. That's usually reserved for patients who have some sort of an infection.
Okay, so now we have this, and you're going in. How did you learn how to do that? I've often wondered about that. You know, there's this thing, somebody invents it laparoscopically, and then everybody who's a good surgeon has to retrain, right?
That is true. So aortic stent grafting was really developed by a fellow named Juan Perotti, who was down in Argentina and a team of physicians there. And he then had that published. He basically made it himself, kind of like on a back table, and inserted it into about somewhere between 5 to 10 patients. And really, he then changed the way vascular surgery was done. And this was back in like 1989 or the early 1990s.
So how did you do it? How did you learn?
Well, I learned in my training. So
in other words, you're young enough so that you learned in your training. And when you were learning in your training, how does that work? Does a senior doctor say, okay, today you're going to fly solo? How do you get there?
Well, No, you don't just fly solo. I mean, I was a vascular fellow, so I'd already done 4 years of medical school, 5 years of general surgery,
Wow.
and basically was a board certified general surgeon. Then did 2 years of vascular training there at Stanford with many of the physicians who were involved with the very early development of these aortic stent grafts. And you work as a team. They're always there and present. And over a period of 2 years, you get graduating responsibilities for the insertion and the management of these patients. But no, not on the first day do you just
No,
go in
nor,
there and
nor did
all
I
of a
mean
sudden
to,
do this.
nor
Right.
did I mean to imply it. I'm just fascinated about how this thing works. Do you remember the day that you did the first one all by yourself?
I don't remember my first case for a stent graft all by myself. I do remember the very first case that I ever did as just right out of practice, kind of all by myself without anyone kind of above me. I certainly remember that case.
Can you tell us about it? Can you tell
Sure,
us that war
sure.
story? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that patient actually had a very bad problem. It wasn't an aneurysm. It was basically mesenteric ischemia.
Which is what?
And it's basically narrowing of the arteries for all the blood vessels in the intestine. And we had to go in there. It's an older lady, smoker, and had been losing some weight and went into the hospital with some pretty severe abdominal pain, and operated on her. And she had already had some very ischemic bowel that had to be resected, but we then revascularized everything, and she eventually did very, very well. Not really the first case that you want to do all by yourself, but she did just fine.
Do you get angry when somebody tells you they're a smoker?
Yes and no. So it's where I get angry is actually watching younger people just start smoking. So that's a little bit more difficult. Once someone has actually started smoking, I don't really get angry or frustrated. I become more sad that we don't have better treatments for them. It is for those who cannot stop. It is a highly addictive drug. It's one that, for many of them who have used a multitude of drugs other than nicotine, it's one that they will say it's the most difficult for them to stop. And they will have stopped every other drug possible. So I think it is a very highly addictive medication. I wouldn't say I get mad. I would say I get frustrated. I have a very long conversation with these individuals who are smoking. It goes more to when they have pretty severe peripheral arterial disease or narrowing of the blood vessels of their legs, and they've undergone many, many bypasses and they continue to smoke. Every time they've had a bypass, and if they continue to smoke, every bypass that we do, the life of that bypass significantly decreases when they continue to smoke. And we really don't have very many good therapies for smoking cessation. And, it goes finally to the end where they lose a limb from their smoking. So it's really more sad.
Dr. Arco, I guess this repair thing now becomes a question of numbers, doesn't it? In other words, if I'm facing this, I would want to ask my potential surgeon, how many of these have you done?
Yeah, I think it's very important to find a individual or an interventionalist who has done a lot of these, and I think those who basically do more vascular procedures really will give you better long-term outcomes. Certainly, in the past, when the only option was open surgery, really only vascular surgeons were fixing these aneurysms. Now, as the procedure has become more of an interventional procedure, at most with two very small incisions in the groin, you've got a lot more specialists attempting to try to do these repairs where they really weren't necessarily trained in doing them. And I think it's very important for patients, when they go to see a surgeon, to number one, ask them the questions that they need to ask, how many that they've done, do you feel comfortable with this, what's your training, and if they don't feel comfortable with them, I think it's certainly not unreasonable to see a second opinion. I oftentimes tell people that I'm meeting for the first time, if you're not comfortable with me, I think it's important for you to go get a second opinion. It's not uncommon. I mean, I don't go buy a car and just buy the first car I see. You know, I go look and shop around and make sure that I am comfortable with the person selling me the car and the car that I'm going to buy. So I think it's important for you to get the amount of information that you need to feel comfortable.
Well, no, that is a perfectly wonderful statement. Nevertheless, I want to go inside your brain and ask you this. When somebody
There's
says...
There's not much in there.
Somebody says, you know, you say to somebody, go get a second opinion. Do you really want them to go get a second opinion, or are you really, you know, just saying what you should say?
I want them to feel comfortable with me. And if they don't, then I absolutely do feel that if they're not comfortable with me, then they should get a second opinion. And, you know, from those two things, try to become as well-educated as they can in the short amount of period that they have to make an informed decision as to what the best therapy is for them. I feel it's my job when someone comes in not to really tell them what they need to have done, but to educate them so that they can make the right decision.
So how many of these operations are done as elective rather than as emergency surgery?
Well, the majority of them are done on an elective basis, fortunately. I would say probably about 80 to, it's hard to say, but I'd say 80 to 90% in my own practice are done on an elective basis. And certainly when done electively, the overall risk of death or some sort of complication, we would call that a mortality or a morbidity respectively, is very, very low. So if you have it done electively, the risk of your having a mortality from the aneurysm repair is probably less than, it should be less than 2% if you're having a stent graft. Large series have reported the risk of mortality being about 1.5%. With open surgery nowadays, that's going to be a more complex surgery based on more complex anatomy. And with that, the mortality, again, in very good hands, is going to be about 3%. When these procedures are done emergently, the risk of death is actually somewhere between 50 to 80% if it ruptures before you ever make it to the hospital. Mm-hmm. If you make it to the hospital, if you're in that small percentage of patients, your risk of mortality, if we operate on you, is somewhere between 40 to 60%. That's if you make it to the hospital. If you survive, you're most likely going to have some major complication, such as colon ischemia or having your colon die, going into kidney failure, requiring dialysis, having a heart attack or stroke. When done electively, all these things markedly decrease. One of the things that we have done in an attempt to try to improve our overall survival in these patients who come in emergently with a ruptured aneurysm. Basically, these patients are in shock. They have a huge hole in the aorta, and it's like being shot. And these are typically elderly patients who cannot do that well with that sort of shock. So in our own Carolina's healthcare system, we've initiated a code rupture, very similar to a code STEMI. So patients who have a heart attack nowadays, they try to get these patients into the door and into the interventional suite and have your vessel open or ballooned within 90 minutes. What we've done is we have initiated a very similar code all throughout the Western Carolinas, and North and South Carolina would be included, is if you diagnose a ruptured aneurysm in an emergency room, we set off a code, and that basically sets off an algorithm and gets everybody who needs to be involved in the care of that patient ready, makes logistics much better. And we have set a time limit of getting that patient in our emergency room and into the operating room and having a balloon up, which we can occlude the blood flow so it's not going out the hole, and attempt to stabilize these patients and fix them and improve the outcomes for these patients. And so far, we've been very successful with that. And there are several other places that have done similar things as well.
So how do you, I mean, what if everybody's at the country club? There can't be that many people who do what you do.
Well, we always have someone on call, and the entire team is on call.
What does on call mean? Does it mean you could be doing anything and you're on call and you got to go in the hospital? But what if you're 20 minutes away?
Well, then you drive fast. but typically, we get the call right away. And if it's in our own emergency room, then we initiate the thing. There are many people who are already in the hospital. And with today's technology, there are ways to look at the images, make sure that they're ruptured, while mobilizing everybody to get there. Now, oftentimes they are, you know, in another hospital 3 hours away. Uh-huh. We get that diagnosis. Yeah. When they're in that other hospital, a helicopter is sent. Everyone is mobilized. We meet that patient right when they're in the hospital. And if they've had a CT scan or some sort of cross-sectional imaging, we can base our therapy on that and take them directly to the operating room. And we will actually, with the patient wide awake, get control of the aorta from going on the inside. And then once we have control of that aorta, then we put the patient to sleep. Because if they come in and they're hemodynamically unstable and they get put to sleep, they become a lot more hemodynamically unstable.
What does that word mean, Doc? What does that word mean, hemodynamic?
Well, they're in shock. Their blood pressure is markedly diminished, which means many parts of their body are ischemic and they're clamped down. And so the body is trying to survive and perfusing the two major organs, which would be the brain and the heart. Mm-hmm. And so the other parts of the body become ischemic. And now one of the most important things with this therapy is that when they're out at these other hospitals or emergency rooms, the concept of what's called permissive hypotension needs to be looked at and taught. So when these patients have a hole in the aorta, they basically have bled out a lot, their blood pressure goes down, and then they'll stop bleeding. As long as they're, you know, cognitive and they're talking to you, we like to keep their blood pressure low, because if we raise the blood pressure or start transfusing them and raise the blood pressure, they just start bleeding again. So it's very important for people to let these people remain with some hypotension so they remain stable. Then when we get them and then we can control the blood vessel, then we will let the blood pressure rise, start transfusing them, fix them, and hopefully limit the amount of blood that they need to be transfused and hopefully increase our overall survival.
How many of these do you do a year personally?
Well, in the Carolinas here, I think we've done probably about two ruptures a month. It would be nice to, again, that's the importance of screening. While we can affect change when you're ruptured, you're still ruptured. So sure. If we can screen these patients, find the aneurysms earlier, treat them when they're of an appropriate size, and limit the number of ruptures, that will greatly increase our survival. So we have the things in place to fix you when you're ruptured and improve your survival, but we need to find patients before they rupture.
And how many electives do you do a year?
Oh, we as a group at Carolina's healthcare system and the Sanger Heart and Vascular Institution do about 250 elective infarenal aneurysm repairs annually, and then we probably do about 70 to 80 thoracic aneurysm repairs.
So you've got this specialty. This is fascinating stuff to me, and your group does what they do. But obviously, this is just one location in the body. Are there other groups for all these other locations, or do you do general stuff that you do with other aneurysms in other places?
No, so we'll fix all aneurysms in the body. I do not do, we as vascular surgeons do not do cerebral aneurysms. Mm-hmm. That's usually left to the neurosurgeons or the neurointerventional radiologists, depending on how they're going to be fixed. But we will also fix splenic artery aneurysms.
Was that the spleen? Yeah.
Yeah, that's an artery out near the spleen that can become aneurysmal. Same with arteries that go to the liver. There can be ones going to the small intestine and then the ones behind the knee. So we will fix all those ones as well. But typically the most common that we fix is the inferior aneurysm, followed by the thoracic aneurysm.
Okay, so let me ask you a hypothetical. If one day all the brain surgeons were out of the hospital and they couldn't be located and there was an aneurysm in the brain, would you do it?
I would not, because having me do it, while I might have the wire set to go up there and do it, I really wouldn't know what was going on, and you wouldn't want me treating you, and I wouldn't do it.
Interesting. So medication. Are there medications, Dr. Arco, that once you discover you have the potential for this, you have a family history, or you actually pick it up on CT or MR, that you could take?
There really are not. There have been many studies looking at a variety of different medicines, which would include the medicines that lower your cholesterol. That would be your HMG-CoA reductase inhibitors. People might know those things as like Lipitor, or I can't remember all the other names, sure. But that's the one that most people are on. There's been others where the use of antibiotics, such as tetracycline or doxycycline, have been evaluated as well to slow the growth of aneurysms. But they really have not been very, very successful at all. Another one has been the use of beta blockers. People might know that as like atenolol or Lopressor in an attempt to prevent the growth of these aneurysms. And again, the data on that has not been very, very good.
We are talking to Dr. Frank Arco. So Dr. Arco, let me ask you this question. Let's say you're a 71-year-old and you're retiring. Based on the expertise that you and your group have, would that 70-year-old be better off living near a university hospital?
Well, that's a great question. I think it doesn't necessarily have to be a university hospital. While I've been at university hospitals, I think they're great, and I've spent most of my career in that. But I think that pretty much any large community hospital or any hospital that has a very good internists, cardiologists, vascular surgeons, cardiac surgeons, that you can get really the same therapy in those sorts of hospitals that you can at an academic sort of institution. So I think that it's important to certainly have those resources available to you. I can tell you that my grandparents have all passed away, but my wife's grandparents are still alive, and they live in a very little tiny mountain town of New Mexico. And there really is not much in the way of the type of medical care that they may need. So oftentimes they go into that local emergency room where there are very good emergency room physicians who can diagnose what's going on. But then they will transfer them to a larger city such as Albuquerque or I can't remember where else they might go, but Albuquerque or El Paso or something like that.
So, but are they facing a risk? Let's just say that's Taos that they're living in. Are they facing a risk by moving to an attractive place, so that, a couple of minutes can make a huge difference, can it?
Right. And my grandfather actually had an aneurysm and had my wife's grandfather had an aneurysm. I actually treated him. But he flew in. He was treated electively, and he lives up there. And, he goes to a larger city, and he gets surveillance and for all those problems. But is there potential risk? I think there is, but that's a risk that you take as you get older. And I think a lot of people would rather live in a beautiful place and enjoy their last days of retirement, however long they have, rather than living in a big, giant, bustling city and dealing with traffic.
So when you treat Dr. Arco, a grandfather on the wife's side, is there pressure? I mean, you say, oh, boy, I better not blow this one. Or my name is Mud in the family.
No, I love that grandfather as much as my wife does. But no, I don't think so. I'm not sure I would treat my own father. But, my family trusts trust me. I mean, I'm not directly related to him. I didn't really have any issues with treating him. He did fine. He was discharged from the hospital.
And, but can you be dispassionate?
Stay with me for a little bit.
Can you be dispassionate about it when you're doing it? In other words, can you say, is this an intervening variable that is much on your mind? No.
It's, you know, I actually become very passionate about all my patients. So I would like to think that I want the outcomes for all my patients that I would want for my wife's grandfather. So I really look at caring for each patient as if they're friends of mine, and I want the best for them. So I think I can. You have to dissociate yourself somewhat from the procedure, and that's, you know, that's really the secret to that blue drape that goes down. Now, once that blue drape goes down, you're basically looking at then doing a procedure. You as a surgeon don't oftentimes see the face. Certainly as a vascular surgeon, you don't. And you go about doing your work the best way that you can.
So we've sometimes been warned about, we touched on this before, but I want to just spend a minute on it, doing an operation in July when the new medical students come on. Do you have medical students at your place?
I do believe that there are medical students at Carolina's healthcare system, but on our vascular surgery service, we don't have many of those students rotate on with us. We do have vascular fellows, so these are people who are older, just like I went through my training, who are involved in part of the procedure. But, you know, in mine, current institution in Carolina's healthcare system, we're a large group of multi-specialty physicians who basically are managing our patients. Now, I certainly have been at two very large, distinguished academic institutions in the past. I worked at Stanford University, and I worked at the University of Texas Southwestern in Dallas, and we had medical students and residents and fellows. And, you know, I think the amount of care that you get is really no different in July than you get in June, which
I'm just
is
talking
the
about
month
when the
before
new, yeah,
new people come
when
on.
The new people come on. But I once had a back operation, so I need an ethical call from you. And I told my surgeon, I don't want any medical student touching me. Now, if obviously the answer to that is, then how's anybody going to learn? But not on me. That was my point.
Right. I've been asked and given that request before, in which people say, very few medical students are actually going to do any procedure on you of any major concern, including back surgery. But they might be involved and in the room, but most of the time medical students are usually watching. You then have residents and fellows. And if someone makes that specific request to me, I'm fine with it, and I will usually do the procedure. Now, the one thing that you need to remember is I tend to do something the same way every single time. And if I've got fellows in there and I've got in a certain routine, I'm having them do certain things, and all of a sudden you want me to change the way that I do something, and I've got, you know, I have a very good record, and you want me to change something all of a sudden the way I do something, then I think you're actually maybe putting yourself in a little bit higher risk by making us change the way we normally do something.
I don't understand. Who would make you do that?
You.
Oh, me. Patient. In other words, if I said to you, look, I don't want it this way, I want it that way, yeah,
right.
I wouldn't do that. Well, I want you to know that we've been talking with Dr. Frank Arco, a vascular surgeon with the Sanger Heart and Vascular Institute and the Carolinas Medical Center in Charlotte, North Carolina. Dr. Arco, you passed. If I have an aneurysm, I'm coming to see you. And I want you to know how enjoyable this whole hour has been. And we thank you for giving up this valuable time that you have.
Well, I appreciate that, sir, and I very much enjoyed speaking with you.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.